Evening, afternoon, whatever time it is, morning, whatever time you listen to this. This is episode 216 of the Edge Futurist podcast. Thanks for joining us. We've had some big news since we were last on the air, gentlemen, haven't we?
Yeah, we had our first face-to-face event for a long time. Still tired. Dan and Ben are still hungover, definitely.
Wow. Speak for yourself. I was not drunk.
Dan's on mute. I think I just caught Dan on mute there.
I've been talking away for half an hour.
Most people who listen on the podcast, Dan said some wonderful things. I couldn't hear him, neither could you, but it looked interesting. It was good, wasn't it? You know what? I'm going to call it out. The feedback and the positivity at the event and after it is a bit overwhelming. Like, it's the first time we put it on. The first thing is, are we getting it right? People are going to turn up.
Yeah,
they enjoy themselves, which is kind of the first kind of target and the focus, really, isn't it? Everything beyond that is kind of just fluff. But I think we kind of achieved what we wanted to. We wanted people to come, feel part of a community, enjoy themselves, connect with different people, and yeah, the feedback is positive, really positive so far. So
for sure. So we had like 100 people in Leeds, just over 100 people, I think it was in Leeds. Great. Partners who work with us, 11 awards went out, probably too many swear words, too many drinks drunk, but lots of good pizza as well. The pizza was good, weren't it? But it was just a good event and an opportunity. We got three people who spoke for us as well, and the great Sagata Mitra was joining us, and Bob Harrison. Just what a brilliant night it was, celebrating educators from around the UK who are doing wonderful things. But we talked about a few things that will come up on the podcast over the next few weeks around the Edge Futurist Wolfpack communities, if you mean to say. We launched this, didn't we? The Trends Booklet for 2022-23, which went down really well. We're trying to put these in the hands of people who are decision makers. So yeah, lots of cool stuff happened. But we've had some interesting meetings. And actually, did you not fly out to Belfast as well, Steve? Were you Belfast, Dublin?
Dublin, yeah. Dublin. Flew up to Dublin on Tuesday morning, kid free, me and the wife, and went to see Bruce Springsteen. So yes. Bruce Springsteen on Tuesday night, one the of boss. The things I've always wanted to do. Came on stage at the age of 74, 75. 3.5 hours non-stop.
Yes.
What an absolute legend that guy is. So yeah, it was good. That's been the highlight of my week post-event. So yeah, how about you guys?
Yeah. Ken Dodge used to do that in his 90s.
I'm guessing the guest in the background has got no idea who Ken Dodge is.
And also, he doesn't do Dancing in the Dark as well, or Born to Run. I don't think the Liverpudlian singing voice was there.
He's got a feather duster, though. Did Bruce Springsteen have one?
Wow, Ken Dodd. Did anybody envisage Ken Dodd coming onto a podcast?
Cheryl, who's waiting in the background, is like, "What is going on?
Dan got confused between Cilla Black and Ken Dodd. He knew the Liverpudlian singer, but or celebrity, but he just couldn't remember which one. But yeah, it was good. It was good.
I definitely meant Ken Dodd.
Well, just to clarify, people have no idea who Ken Dodd is. They might know who Cilla Black is. She was famous for a moment in the 60s. So I don't think Ken Dodd ever went beyond the boundaries of England and the UK.
I don't know. Go on his Wikipedia page, Steve. I'm sure.
On social media, see whether he's still posting. How about Dan? Where have you been? Hong Kong, China, England. Where are we this week?
I'm just in this room.
Have you not left? But where have you beamed into? That's the interesting bit.
I know. We all live like that now, though, don't we? Like, I think I had a conversation with pretty much on every continent yesterday, and all from this room. But all good. Just got off with some training with some head teachers in the southwest of England, doing some AI stuff with them. I had one of those. I made the mistake. I don't know how you guys manage this, but I made the mistake of I have my Calendly link on my website.
Problem. Straight away. There we go.
So yesterday, well, Tuesday night, I looked at my diary for the following day, for Wednesday, and thankfully I started at 10 a.m., but went on. I'm just looking at my diary now till 8:30. And I think I had a half an hour spare in there, just non-stop back to back. I mean, it was amazing conversations and loved it, but I need to sort that Calendly link out.
You have to wait. Oh, you can set it so that you have to accept, can't you, in Calendly? So it doesn't automatically go into your diary.
Oh, can you?
I think you're giving. Are you giving tech advice here, Steve?
I'm just clarifying that Dan's one warning about the fact he's busy making money, and two, also the fact that he doesn't know how to use Calendly. But
I am on the free version, to be fair. I don't know if you can do it with the free version.
You can, because I'm from Yorkshire and I definitely won't be paying for anything. So you can. So, Ben, how about you?
Yeah, it's been a good week. Nothing as exciting as speaking to people all around the world, although I do fly to South Africa next week. So I'm looking forward to that, part of the Innovate EDU conference out there. So looking forward to seeing all the people out in South Africa. Have I done anything interesting? Oh, we had the old, I don't know if I should mention this, but we had the old Corrie Nash, didn't we, in England over the weekend, the coronation. So we had a bit of fun just with the kids and watching that, and a bit of fun. But I mentioned it and Dan and Steve grimaced at me, so I'll stop talking about it any longer. It was just a nice bank holiday, weren't it? So we have got a guest in the background, so let's stop talking about anything before these two fall out with me, because I mentioned anything that isn't Republican. It's great to welcome a guest for this evening. So beaming in all the way from the US, we have got Cheryl is joining us from Substantial. Cheryl, tell us a little bit about you. Thank you for joining us this evening, and just give our listeners a little bit about your background.
Hi, can I first say you are correct that I did not know who Ken Dodd is.
Cheryl, I thought you were about to say that, but can I just say, I'm a massive Ken Dodd fan. I thought that's what you were going to say there.
No, I literally had to Google him, and it's funny, the photos that come up when you Google.
Do you have him, has he got a feather duster in his hand?
I think in one photo, yes. But I was like, okay, I just closed the tab. It's fine.
It's all good. It's not like it's nothing X-rated. It's you make it sound like you've come across something you shouldn't have.
Very interesting character. So I'm calling in from Seattle, and I'm the chief strategy officer at Substantial, which is research insights and development studio. And a lot of our strategic work is in education, and our practice is focused on equity-centered design within education. And so we work with our clients in EdTech to help to increase equity throughout their processes, as well as philanthropies and funders who work with educational institutions. So that's kind of the focus of our work.
Sorry, Steve, go on.
I was just going to say, Cheryl, just on that, for those people who go in, sounds wonderful. What does it even mean? So we do have some listeners and me, but I'm guessing that, you know, that whole equity center is around, is it focused on that beliefs and values in terms of the design structure, or what does it actually mean for when you're starting to maybe create a framework? I know, because I was doing some research earlier, and Stanford did some, and doing some, quite a bit of work on it.
Yeah. So essentially, a lot of what we do is we consider how product developers engage students throughout the process of kind of developing ed tech products. We also, as I mentioned before, work with funders to use basically human-centered design to help inform their funding strategies around education. So we do a lot of work, for example, with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And what that means is that we're kind of taking the design process. I think some people have heard of design thinking or human-centered design, and we're kind of ensuring that product developers are integrating that within their processes, and not only kind of like integrating design thinking, but also thinking about who is most marginalized, in the education community, what kinds of students are essentially kind of left out of the process? What kinds of students come from communities that are historically under-resourced? Doing a lot of our work in U.S. education, for example, we're focused on how Black and Latino students experience essentially like our education system and educational products, and how do we kind of create things that respond better to their needs in terms of like systemically, as well as, you know, in terms of like cultural relevance, and how do we kind of like bake that into the design and product development process?
So I know we're getting to the principles of what that means in terms of equity-centered design and thinking about the human experience for people from a variety of different backgrounds. What does that, just before we get into that, what does that practically look like? Could you give us like maybe an example of what we need to do in terms, what people need to do in terms of developing a product that is focused on equity?
Yeah, so we think of our process. So the design thinking process is usually broken out into five steps. There's empathize, which is kind of understanding the context of, you know, in which your product is going to sit, how people are going to use it, you know, basically kind of like the environment and sort of their mindsets and behaviors. And then there's define. So kind of using that understanding to drive, you know, how you might problem solve for them. And then after that is ideate. So moving into the kind of like the design process, you start kind of thinking about or generating ideas for problem solving. Maybe this features within your edtech product, for example. And then lastly, there's prototype and test. So you build lightweight prototypes just like, you know, continuously, and you test those directly with people who will be end users and end beneficiaries of your product. So in edtech, oftentimes that's teachers and students. And so for us, our sort of goal is throughout that process to ensure that we're elevating student voice. So as consultants, we act as sort of advocates for engaging students throughout that process. And that means when, you know, you're conducting interviews with students early on, that you can kind of understand their context. Like we were recently worked on a funding strategy around math, you know, how to solve for Algebra 1. Like in the US, Algebra 1 is kind of like a gateway course for middle school students. And so we interviewed middle school students, and specifically those who are from historically under-resourced communities. So students, you know, who are experiencing poverty, students who are Black and Latino. And we interviewed them, we engaged them in sort of like co-design and participatory design processes, and then created sort of like ideas that could be leverage points in changing their outcomes and experience in this space. So what could, for example, the Gates Foundation invest in that would change their experience and sort of like create greater impact and improve their outcomes in this space? And now their product developers who have been funded through this process are going through that process of like ideating, prototyping, and testing. So testing with students, ensuring that they're also engaging teachers who, you know, work with students within those demographics. Yeah, oftentimes when we're working with the Gates Foundation too, we call them priority students because like we're prioritizing how we design for their experience with the philosophy that of universalist design, which is that if you kind of solve for those who are kind of like at the extreme end of the spectrum, who are having kind of like the worst experiences, others are likely going to benefit. So rather than starting with the students who are maybe in the most privileged environments, you start with the students who are in the most under-resourced environments and kind of solve for their problems. And very likely it'll have sort of like a trickle-up effect in terms of like benefiting other students as well.
I love that. And it's obviously based around that idea that a rising tide lifts all the ships, and this idea of how when you're developing a product or you're developing a piece of software or whatever else, you're not just doing it's interesting this actually, as my mind goes into something else. Like, it's really interesting when you work with tech companies, and we've all worked with tech companies, and some of us still do. This idea that sometimes we try and create things that we like, or things that we think will work, or people like us will work, and generally, that causes a problem, and then you start thinking about user experience and customer delight and all the stuff that sits with that. Actually, we are not the heroes in the story, are we? As the companies, the heroes are the users. We need to make sure that they have that experience of that hero's journey, and we become the guides in that journey. So I love this idea of the stages through that process. But much of that, I'm guessing, must need to spend the majority of time in the empathy and definition stages, because if we don't understand that process, you're going to end up going down a route that is not useful for anybody. Is that tending to where you spend time?
Yeah, if you don't understand the context. So, for example, there are, you know, schools and school districts in the U.S. that struggle with like basic internet connectivity. And so if you're kind of like, oh, we're product developers, we're going to kind of develop, I don't know, let's say like a tutoring platform or something like that. And it makes all these assumptions about like the speed of networks and things like that. And if you're kind of testing it, let's say like you're in some sort of suburban office park or something, your company, and you're just like testing with the school next door, which is kind of like a very well-resourced suburban white dominant school. You might make assumptions about like the kinds of access people have to connectivity or just to the internet. And I think what goes wrong then is like, then as they're trying to scale up or expand that product, you run into all these issues that you didn't know existed. Like, oh, students don't have access to devices. Oh, a lot, there's students who are kind of like literally doing their work on a mobile phone and things like that, that you might have, if you had kind of like understood the context in the beginning, you might have been more, I don't know, creative, innovative, or like better at problem solving as you kind of like go into the process of like designing products and services.
Yeah, look, that I do a lot. I started doing a lot of work with companies using design thinking and trying to get them to think about how to develop AI tools really that are going to be useful, because I think we're seeing a lot at the moment. We're seeing a lot of tools that are just essentially kind of the same thing. It's ChatGPT with a skin on it for educators, but actually solving some problems. And it's amazing. I absolutely love being in the room and facilitating those types of sessions, because just to see the creativity and of people who didn't think that they knew the answers. Like I always love it, because they think they're getting your in. They think they're hiring me to come and provide the solutions, but actually it's them that's providing the solutions, and it's amazing to see the creativity there. Like I was quite fortunate to do a postgraduate diploma in design thinking at MIT a couple of years ago, and just absolutely blew my mind with what's capable and what you're saying there as well about universal approaches to creating these products and creating these solutions. It just really hits home, and I think because my mind's in AI a lot at the moment, and actually how the a lot of solutions at the are waiting to be solved with this new technology.
Yeah, totally. I think like AI is a really good example in terms of like how would you engage students, for example, to like kind of think about how they might use AI and how could that inform potential development or solutions or what have you. Like I was talking to somebody the other day. So, my computer just like totally just like shut down for a second. I'm glad it did not actually like turn. Okay. So I was talking to somebody the other day who, so we have a lot of English as a second language and multi-language learners in the US. And she was talking about how she was using ChatGPT to just do like basically like grammar checks like on her writing. And she was like, it would still not be like it's you still had to like go through it and like correct it after ChatGPT went through it because it's not perfect. But I think it's like it's a good example of like if you were able to get like teachers and students together in a space to kind of like, I don't know, engage in like some sort of participatory design activity or ideation activity around ChatGPT, I think you could come up with some interesting solutions, especially if you're kind of engaging the students who, you know, maybe have in some cases like the worst experiences within the education system. I think multi-language learners definitely fall into that category, at least where I live. And so it's a little bit like an example I use a lot are like curb cuts, right? Like, so curb cuts have been required for, you know, being able to facilitate accessibility for folks in wheelchairs and things like that. But so many other people have benefited from curb cuts. You know, you're pushing a baby stroller down the street or you're pushing a cart or a wagon or something like that. And it becomes useful or you're like walking your bike. So many other people benefit. Same with things like closed captioning, right? Like I have kids and I don't know if I ever watch a movie at home anymore, like TV without closed captioning on because like there's so much noise around me and what have you. And so I think it's like one of those things where like you've designed it for this certain subset of people who maybe fall at the extreme end of who might be using your product, but so many other people tend to benefit. And I think that's one way we can kind of think about emerging technologies too, is like, I think innovation can actually come from that space of like serving those who have the most extreme experiences within the system.
I'm not sure if it was just UK based data, but something was released a few weeks ago that said that the biggest users of closed captioning on television are 18 to 25 year olds. And that's just not the market that it was created for.
Yeah, I think there was on buses and in airports is its biggest use.
Right.
The only reason I'm thinking is I was in the airport and I was like, I couldn't hear the TV. My AirPods had died, so I just read the TV. I was like, it was just, and you think about it now, and I was like, I literally just in the airport read the TV for.
But I do the same thing on my social media as well, because usually I'm watching videos while my wife's asleep next to me. That's watching it on. So actually, it is, and that kind of principle around thinking about the person who needs it most, and actually that will win for everybody. It's a good process, and it's a process that kind of make sure everybody wins, and that's the whole process around equity, isn't it? It's that idea. One of the things that we wanted to get into today is the principles that that kind of govern this equity-centered research and the process that goes behind it. So I wondered if you could talk at that and the kind of work that you're doing with people like the Gates Foundation and beyond.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting, like as we work closely with product developers, I think so. Some of the specifics around the types of edtech developers we work with, like they're basically tasked with increasing, like making their products more equitable because of their funding. Their funding is kind of like tied to this. And so what we found is like they're receiving grants from organizations like the Gates Foundation, right? And a lot of them really like this idea. Like they're like, yeah, this is like the right thing to do. But one, they don't necessarily know where to begin, because some of them are not even like doing research like with students and teachers to begin with. So then if we walk in and we're kind of like, yeah, not only do you need to be doing research with students and teachers, you need to be doing research with students and teachers who are from historically under-resourced environments, and knowing kind of like the privileges within a lot of edtech companies, they're like, oh, we don't have any connections to schools or, you know, people in those spaces. And I think there's like a level of intimidation too, is like, we don't know how to do this. And two, how do we do it correctly? So there's a couple of ways that we provide just sort of like, I guess what we call like equity technical assistance. So it's like, okay, how can you as an organization within your processes, and maybe even in terms of like your mindset, become like embed this idea of equity, like within just like your organization, your products. And one of the things is like, yeah, it might boil down to things like, what can you change organizationally? Like, do you need different hiring strategies? Do you not have enough diversity in your organization? Because that increasing the diversity in your organization is like one good way to like, yeah, increase perspective. Secondly, when you're kind of working with students and teachers who kind of like work in historically under-resourced environments, you have to recognize kind of like the power differential between you and them. Like, you hold a lot of power as somebody who can interact with them and then make decisions on their behalf. Like, oh, I can represent their perspective and turn that into features or something within this edtech product. And I think what's important is to sort of try to minimize that and give them more power within the process. That means, I know I've said, referred to the term like co-design. That means like really engaging them like in workshops and things like that, where they are actually empowered to like give their opinion, be part of the problem solving, and that you're not just like extracting their stories of what's not working for them. So we kind of contrast this to traditional forms of research where you're meant to be just kind of like, you should be objective. You need to kind of just understand somebody's context by like listening and watching. We acknowledge that you're bringing to the table certain biases, certain privileges, and it's your job to kind of minimize that. And so like actually making yourself part of the process and understanding you're part of the system means also like being reciprocal, like sharing your experiences with, you know, what we would call research participants, and easing their uncertainty, like building a personal connection, and also like giving them opportunities to like decide what they want to share, as well as like decide like how they want to be involved. And I think like at the core, the objective is to kind of like minimize the power imbalance. I don't think you'll ever like eradicate it, because like, of course, you're going to go off and like lead design things. They're not going to be the hands-on designers of like your edtech product. But I think like ensuring first and foremost that you're kind of like having these touch points with students and teachers throughout your process, and doing it in a way that feels empowering to them rather than extractive, I think is like a really nice way of like integrating equity into your process and your product development process.
So how much effort must go into engaging with the community and the potential users and feeling that they're part of it, but also making sure that's part of the research that you're collecting enough data to evidence and influence the next step and actually the product you're going to create? Can you walk us through the juggle and the challenge of that, I guess?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think that's one of the biggest sort of like, I don't know, that's the biggest pushback we get, is like, look, we're on just like this like razor thin, like, you know, tightly defined timeline already, and you're asking us to basically, you know, stop what we're doing at every turn and figure out a way of engaging students. I think at first, yeah, it's probably quite a lift in terms of like time and resources because you're learning how to do it. But some of the things that we recommend is setting, like, for example, a student advisory group, you know, for your organization. So these are students you would engage like on a regular basis. So they get familiar with you, you start building trust, and they're aware of like what you're building and can basically give you input. Teachers too. So having like a teacher advisory body. So it's like some of the organizations we've worked with already have that, where it's like there's a group of teachers from kind of like diverse backgrounds who you kind of engage in like testing and ideating and things like that. And once you kind of set that up, that kind of minimizes like the amount of time it takes to create connections with like new people. So I think it's like when we think about the process and you're going through developing like an ed tech product, there's the first step of like, let's say you're thinking of adding a new feature to, you know, we've worked a lot on courseware, for example, in the post-secondary space. So like if you're creating a digital courseware product, you're thinking about like, okay, what does the dashboard look like? How do we integrate, I don't know, some forms of communication or something? So you do interviews or workshops with teachers and students who, you know, maybe have taken that course or what have you, are at the kinds of institutions and fit the demographic with whom you were wanting to do research. And then you you essentially kind of understand their current experiences with either your current product or other products if you're designing something new. And then you would kind of like take those inputs and draw insights from them, and then bring those same people ideally kind of back to the process to then ideate on how can we potentially solve for this. So you are going back, you're kind of like doing some work without them in terms of like, I don't know, synthesizing or kind of creating inputs for them to engage further. And you do this all the way through like building your product. And I think it feels like a heavy lift early on. But one thing that I argue, just as somebody who's been in product design just broadly, like in the technology sector, is you actually save a lot of money by investing in this process, because you can then make quick decisions based on quick prototypes, for example, and go through the trouble of testing it, then find out what's wrong with it before you like invest in software development and like build the whole thing out, and then find out when you pilot it that there's all these problems and you have to kind of go back to the drawing board or you have to make a lot of adjustments or whatever. So adjusting it before that all happens is actually a good way to fix the problems before they're released.
Yeah, I think going through the process, Ben, we've not taught this for a long time actually, the Innovator Academy at Google, going through the work based on Jake Knapp, Sprint.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know Jake.
We'll connect after. We'll see what we can get more. So like going through that process of and doing it at Google, like they tell you the story in terms of the Pixar pitch at the end and the storytelling element. But I love the fact that it was about bringing problems or a problem and not the solution, and then spending 5 days or 3 days trying to go through that and trying to look at like massive of ideas, go as crazy, 10x as Google always call it. Like, this is potentially the problem. What could you get? Like, and what could you produce from like a robot? And I think somebody said like an AI assistant for every person. Well, that's coming to fruition pretty quickly. But going through all of that and then doing the crazy aches, and I think the kind of testing, like the getting our head around it, was run by Les Macbeth at Future Design School, and talking about actually how can you design a different solution to sit in. And like, it was about, rather than thinking about a chair, it was about loads of different things, like, you know, pants that like had a special mechanism that just helped you sit down but standing up. And then I find it fascinating. I really enjoyed it, and removing technology from that process, and what they say obviously in Sprint is within 5 days you can walk through and kind of either cement your idea, change it, iterate it, and all of the process. So how much does yours relate to the sprint theory rather than the whole design thinking methodology, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the sprint method is basically like a truncated design thinking process, right? It's just like you're fitting it into a week rather than spending a few months kind of going through this. So it is a good way to engage. I think it's a good way to engage the kinds of populations that I'm talking about. Like, we oftentimes refer to like teachers and students in our work as lived experts, because they're not necessarily like experts in the system or in software development, but they're lived experts in that they're meant to be kind of like the recipients of the things that you're designing, and they're meant to be users. And so I think the sprint, sprint process. I find it a bit short, like just like in terms of like, you have to have a very targeted type of problem space in order to like do that kind of work in a week. But it is useful for kind of like getting things off the ground and really testing things really quickly and being able to like prototype things. And then afterwards, further like testing with students and teachers, for example. And I think like part of it is it's really nice to engage students like through that process, whether you're doing the sprint process within a week or whether you're kind of like doing, you know, a stretched out process over a few months. The reason is that, I don't know, I can't remember the name of the founder, but there's this one kind of startup founder who has said, fall in love with your problem space, like rather than the solution. So it's like that, building that understanding of what are the problems you're trying to solve. Also, not just like the problem space, but what are the potential opportunities? You know, like when you have constraints, such as let's say kind of you're doing some research with rural school districts in the US and you're like, wow, some of these schools don't even have internet connectivity. And then with some of them, the connectivity is really bad. That's a constraint that you can work with to get creative about how do you solve for this. And it might manifest like some solutions that fall outside of what you were initially thinking about. Like maybe you need to have like partnerships to provide hotspots or what have you. You might have to engage in like a different kind of business model. Maybe you need to have like an offline solution. And I think these are where solutions get really interesting, is when you have the kinds of constraints that are provided to you through your understanding of sort of these users who have extreme experiences within the system. And I think like part of our principles for just increasing equity is really like go through this sprint process. I think like, for example, the sprint process is really like agnostic to who's in the room, and it's usually just like, whoever's going to be working on the product, and then who are like the decision-making stakeholders, they pop in every now and then. But I think you come up with like really different ideas when you have lived experts in the room. So like making sure that you're doing this work with students and teachers. And honestly, like I've done work with like middle school students, with high school students, with post-secondary students. And it's like, they all come up with things like you never would have thought of, right? Because they're kind of like living that life in that classroom. And so I think it's actually such a good way of like, I don't know, maybe also taking the pressure off of you and your product development team, like coming up with those hundreds of ideas, if you're doing it with students, like there's going to be some really interesting things there that might lead to nothing. And that might lead to something like that you never thought about before.
As part of that work, and when you're engaging with the organizations and kind of saying that we're going to engage with students and teachers and the community, is there a focus that you have to agree, not like a contract, but to then say, look, if you want to do it this way, you have to listen, you have to be led a little bit by and influenced by the research. Otherwise, it's just a waste of time. Is there anything where actually you have to, at the beginning, you have to really kind of lay it out to people you're working with to then say, look, this is the process. You have to believe and be embedded in the process. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a product that you should have just designed on your own without really being focused on equity and human-centered design, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're lucky in that a lot of the organizations we work with do have a sense like that they should be doing this, and that, you know, this aligns with their philosophy, particularly with, like, you know, people who are working in ed tech. They're invested in creating positive impact, right? And creating like positive social change. So it's not much of an, like, I don't think we have to make much of an argument. Of course, like, I think as in any technology space, and because I've worked like broadly with technology companies, there's lots of hubris and lots of ego and like lots of like, oh, I know about this technology, I know how this can change. I mean, like, you know, there's a reason like Elon Musk comes from the tech sector, right? There's like a lot of just like assumptions that I know what's best. I mean, look what he's doing to Twitter, right? Like, there wouldn't be convincing him to be like, hey, I think you should like involve the users and be more open to the idea of like human-centered design. Like, it's just like, it's almost like laughable kind of thinking about that. But I do think like we've been lucky to kind of work with product developers who do believe in like improving outcomes from an equity standpoint. Like, they don't want to be associated with something that only serves like the most wealthiest students, or, you know, the students who are only in like really expensive private education environments. Like, that's not their goal. Also, it's not like, I don't know, like, they're trying to strategize to get to be able to like scale up. And what that means is like serving public school environments. And yeah, what that means is like you're serving students as citizens. You're not serving like students as just like private customers, right? So I think there's, yeah, kind of a vested interest in this idea, at least with folks that we work with. I think there's political environments where this kind of like perspective can be difficult to swallow, definitely here in the States. But yeah, like, we haven't really like encountered resistance, I guess, in a way to kind of the way we want to approach things. And they recognize like this is hard at first, but it does feel like it'll save us in the long term. Like, they don't want to release things either that they're going to get it wrong.
Yeah. And I think what you're not suggesting is that we kind of push to the average, and like we've all seen them experiments where the one about the pilots and the average, they decided to create an average cockpit size, and it actually fit nobody. And we talk regularly on this about one size fits all actually fits none, because you're not talking about that measure. You're talking about actually hearing from extremes in terms of the spectrum, the very, and then everything within, because it will then lead to that. We're not talking about making things average, are we? We're talking or pushing things to an average. We're saying we need to learn from a broader data set is essentially where we're going from, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I appreciate that example. I think who's the guy who wrote that book, The End of Average? And he talks about that example of like the pilots and how they basically found there is no average body type. Like, everybody is different. And so within Todd education,
Rose.
Yes. Yeah. 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 It's a really good book. And I think like there's this idea maybe like in education that we can design for the average. That's kind of like, I don't know, maybe baked into how we design educational practices. And I feel like that's sort of shifting. Like, we're not talking about that. We're talking about, you know, we do, like, within the Gates Foundation, they use this concept called targeted universalism. So it's like universalist design, but you're like targeting it towards a certain subpopulation so that you're making the assumption that designing it for them will have radiating effects in terms of like others who will benefit. So there are certain methods, like, for example, if you kind of design for students at the margins, in a way that, let's say you want to make math more culturally responsive. So making it feel more relevant to like their day-to-day life, that doesn't mean like for Latino students putting in word problems that involve like, you know, I don't know, Mexican food, which I've literally seen before when you talk about cultural relevance, is that, you know, some curriculum developers might be like, okay, well, we're just going to change the names in our, you know, in our word problems so that they're more like the names of the kids like in this environment. And that's not really like cultural relevance. It's more about like, okay, how do you make it relevant to students in different environments? And what that means is like, you might have to create opportunities for teachers to create that sense of like cultural relevance for their own specific classroom. Cause like every classroom is different. Like the kids in that environment are different. There are like micro trends in schools, right? Or in like student cultures that you could sort of infuse into basically like the your examples or what have you. And what that means for us is like trying to encourage the product developers that we work with to kind of think about sometimes just like how things can be customized so that they'll be more relevant to your students. How can you kind of like localize like what you're doing in a way that's more relevant rather than like the product developers themselves kind of deciding what's like culturally relevant. So yeah, kind of like back to your original question, I don't think like we're talking about like what's going to work for the average. It's kind of like understanding what are the most difficult circumstances that, you know, certain populations of students are experiencing and designing for that. And then also kind of like having an understanding of how that might radiate out to like other student populations.
Yeah, I love it. And I think some of this ties into like that system thinking as well, doesn't it? That actually we're not just talking about individual products, we're talking about a broader system change. And from a future education perspective, we're not just talking about ed tech here, we're not just talking about programs and software, we're talking about actually this principle and this way of doing research and the way of doing curriculum development or school development actually can benefit from these principles, can't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think that that's another angle to our work is like, we, even though, you know, our sort of core principle is like elevating student voice throughout our work, we also need to take that sort of systems lens that surrounds like whatever it is that, you know, our clients are designing, because that could be the difference between success and failure, right? Is like, not understanding like who other stakeholders are in the system, like who are administrators in the school district. How does this intersect with policy, like educational policy, wherever you're sort of enacting what you're doing? You know, we were working on a project recently that was oriented around like what kind of incremental change can you make when it comes to assessments. And yeah, the whole assessment story is so messy, like throughout the US, like different states have different assessment models, like they're using assessment data for things that they were never intended to be used for. Like they're using like formative assessments to shape funding for school districts, which is like bananas because formative assessments are meant to like inform practice and improve practice. So I think there's just like this understanding that you need to build about the surrounding system. And yeah, it's like that's kind of like inherent within our work. I think the other thing that helps with is sort of, you know, one of our principles is to take a strengths-based or assets-based approach. So understanding the strengths that, for example, the most marginalized students bring to the table, because I think there is actually this sort of, I don't know, like systemic bias against them that puts the onus on the students, like, oh, they're lazy. Like I've literally had teachers say, like, my students are really lazy. And what I realized was like, oh, this person is working in an environment where all of their students are English as a second language. And I was like, there's something not quite right here. And I think like understanding like what the strengths are that students bring to the table, regardless of their circumstances, helps you kind of design to essentially, I don't know, amplify those strengths. I think there's like, it's really interesting. A good example is like, we're doing a project in post-secondary, and we're engaging students who had dropped out of school. And we ended up like shifting the language because of kind of like the participatory design we were doing with them to describe their experience as being pushed out, because we realized like there's so many systemic factors that have nothing to do with essentially their choice to drop out. And the terminology of dropping out is so problematic because it makes it sound like, oh, you just decided to stop going to school. And in many ways, they're like kind of pushed out of their, you know, university or college system because of just like a myriad of factors. You know, it could be just like the lack of advising, the financial lack of clarity, the fact that they're working and taking care of like their own kids, for example. And it really felt like to continue describing this as dropped out would leave out these potential opportunity spaces for institutions and for like product developers and problem solvers to solve for, funders too, to solve for.
I was on mute again. I'm off mute again. So yeah, I think it's, I just love the approach, like, and especially in here in the UK, and I know this place, there's certain schools in the US and other places around the world as well that very much take a traditional approach to education or kind of a non-consultatory approach when it comes to, well, we know best and we know how to, why would we ask the students, especially when it comes to something as important as learning design. Which just sounds so counterintuitive and goes, it flies in the face of kind of everything you've said over the last 50 minutes. But it makes sense. And I love exploring this type of topic. I think it was a few months ago, we had somebody on, I forget where they were from now, but it was a country in Europe, and they essentially work with students to design the school building. She's an architect, and she works with the children to actually design the physical spaces. And it just makes sense if this is going to be like the place where students are formed, their characters are formed, their learning happens, and that they know what's going to help, and they know. And also it's the whole approach as well, isn't it, that actually our students have got something to offer right now. It's not like we open the door when they're 18 years old or 21 years old and then they start contributing. They're actually contributors right now. Like, it's, yeah, I think the whole approach is just it's refreshing, and I think we need more of it. So it's been great to just I haven't done much talking in this episode. I've just been kind of listening, and I think it's great to hear that this is going on, and that especially the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are supporting projects like this as well is fantastic. So yeah, thanks for coming on, Cheryl. We really appreciate it, and for taking up your time to share this with us.
Yeah, thanks so much. This has been a really fun conversation. I loved your questions, and yeah, I just encourage, get students involved in your product design and development work.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for coming on.
Fantastic. I just had that line from Frasier in my head. You know, when it says, good morning, Seattle. I don't know why, but I love Frasier. One of my favorite TV shows ever.
I am based in Seattle, and I always remind people, Frasier's view is not real. No single apartment in Seattle has that view.
What about Meg Ryan's? It was Sleepless in Seattle, wasn't it? That was Meg Ryan, wasn't it? Was it Meg Ryan?
Yeah, it was Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks, right?
Meg Ryan. So,
and the fact that I think he lived on a houseboat here. Those do exist. They are absurdly expensive.
Love it. Well, there we go. We finish with a typical edgy futurist idea, something random, Frasier, houseboat, Sleepers in Seattle. Thanks for joining us, Cheryl.
Yeah.
Yes.
Cheryl,
thank you. Thanks
very much. Enjoy the rest of your day. Bye-bye.
Right.
You too. 1, 2, 3.